Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, we've got this.
There's one word that I want us to take with us on the journey and to set the tone for everything we do. That word is confidence.
Confidence?
Brilliant.
Sure.
Christ. There are going to be challenges ahead, of course there are, but we are fortunate enough to be sitting at the centre of the greatest broadcasting organisation, arguably one of the greatest ideas in the world.
BBC. BBC.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, we've spent the last year looking at the future of media funding here in Ireland, but we're going to turn our attention today to the UK and look at the BBC. What challenges are they facing and how might that compare to our own media landscape here in Ireland? And in the US, Lauren Feder from the Financial Times was looking at the presidential debate, and she'll be joining us later to look at the fallout for both Trump and Harris as we enter a crucial phase in the US presidential race. Back home, another Harris was making the headlines here, as the government says the 13 billion euro windfall from the Apple tax ruling won't affect this year's budget. But with the Dáil set to return this week, how much cash is actually available? We'll be looking back at the promises made over the summer and what it would cost the government if everything they've pledged actually came to pass. You can contact me on email at takingstock@newstalk.com or we're open on Twitter at StockNT. So first up today, listeners will be more than aware of the turmoil surrounding RTE and its funding model. We've been going over and over for the past year, but the same issues that we have here in Ireland are also really prevalent across the Irish Sea in the UK. With the BBC taking a pummeling from the Conservatives over the past number of years, that coupled with the dwindling number of people who are now willing to pay their licence fee, what does the future hold for the UK's state broadcaster? And are they losing their relevance in an increasingly globalised media landscape? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by media commentator Jim Waterson. Jim, you're welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get into the funding model and what's happening, just maybe take a step back a second, because the BBC is such an iconic brand in the UK, but also all over the world, renowned for its wonderful news service and sports coverage and all that. But maybe take us through, like, you know, where it was in its heyday as a cultural reference in the media and cultural landscape in the UK, and where that sits now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you went back, say, to the start of this century in 2000, you know, the BBC had a dominant position in so many areas that it would now be fighting to maintain. You know, that was pre-digital TV being widespread. So you only really had five main channels in the UK, with the BBC with two of them. If you put something on BBC One News, it would set the agenda. It had dozens of radio stations and it was in an expansion mode. It was putting money into digital. License fee revenue was going up. You had a supportive Labour government. And really, over the next 2.5 decades, it's sort of been a combination of attacks from governments of both colours and also just changing consumer habits. And you've really got a strange situation now where you've got the BBC still sort of trying to be and acting in many ways like that thing that you'd have seen at the turn of the century. And it's just not got the same resources or an ability to do it. Mm. And the really big decisions that are coming down the track, and this affects RTE as much as the BBC is, at what point do you make that jump and say, we can no longer be the thing that we used to be? And can you get the audiences to buy into that transition and come with you? Or do you risk blowing up the whole joint in the process? And that's the question that all these public broadcasters, whether it's in Ireland, whether it's in the UK, whether it's across Europe or anywhere else in the world, that's what they're all facing. How do you make that transition to digital without losing the existing audience and bringing in the younger viewers?
Mm. And it's increasingly something I think that, as you say, is challenging broadcasters all over the world. But it's almost like a terrier looking into a mirror and still seeing a bulldog and feeling great, but the reality is very different. And that, of course, particularly for the BBC, is to do with funding. And then we have to look at the licence fee. So what's happening around the licence fee collection there at the moment in terms of changed attitudes towards paying it? And how is it collected, actually, in the UK?
The TV licence is levied on every household in the UK that watches live TV or uses the BBC's iPlayer streaming service. And in reality, a lot of it comes down to being honest and whether or not you're willing to ignore enforcement notices through your door. If you do ignore them and then they catch you watching TV at home and they do send inspectors around to check, then there's a good likelihood that you'll end up in court and you could end up with a criminal conviction because it's still a criminal offence not to pay the licence fee in the UK. That itself is a bone of contention because the people who tend to answer the door during the day tend to be poorer people, often women, often single mothers living at home. So there's a sort of social justice element to those who don't pay the license fee and can't afford it. But really the whole system, to my mind, is starting to feel a bit anachronistic, that we levy this duty on owning a specific piece of equipment that receives live television. And whether or not you believe that the BBC has a role to play, whether or not you believe in public service broadcasting and distinctive, in my case, British broadcasting, you know, can you morally justify that? It's certainly not a system you'd invent if you're starting now, but can you morally justify having a criminal offence for non-payment of support for essentially mainly the BBC?
And of course, it is a big political issue as well, because the collection without consequences system is running for quite some time now, and it'll be a brave politician to change that. But of course, this is all against a Labour government coming in now and warning everybody that there's this big £22 billion black hole that they didn't know about. So I guess everything's up for grabs. What are the Labour Party saying?
Well, the Labour Party is sort of, I think there are a few people at the BBC who are high-fiving when Labour got in, not necessarily because of the politics, because, well, you know, the nasty times are over. We're not going to have a government that just blames everything on the BBC, that says, you know, the BBC isn't patriotic because it's, you know, by its own admission, I think the BBC feels it got Brexit wrong and misjudged the mood. But it's certainly then maybe overcorrected. And you've got this odd situation where... they're trying to get a supportive government that backs sort of investment in the creative arts, investment in the BBC, but it's still going to be politically difficult to have the government grant a much larger license fee settlement at a time when a lot of people are really feeling the pinch. And this is all about it. You know, 500,000 households cancelled their license fee in the UK last year. If that keeps going on, then the BBC is going to have less and less income at the exact time it needs to be investing. Inflation is eating away at what the money that it does bring in can actually buy. And every time the BBC tries to actually cut a service, the politicians go up in arms. You know, I support an absolutely terrible lower league English football team, and I get live commentary on a local BBC station of every single match. I think that's fantastic value. Can I really justify the fact that they do it? Probably not. And that's all the tension, you know. Is it public service because they provide that for a few thousand people who really care? Or is that a waste of money when you're not really serving the future audience who wants something radically different and you need to invest in online? There's so many political elements to this. When you try and cut BBC local radio, then people get up in arms because politicians no longer have a place to go on air and talk to their local constituents. And yet, are younger people actually listening to those things? It's so hard to swear circles.
It's such a sticky problem because, as you say, everyone's invested in what they're invested in. Before we go on, you have to tell me, what's the team that you're watching every week?
it's York City, but there was a period when I used to go over and watch League of Ireland matches, so that you've got a flavour for sort of what sort of football I'm into as well.
Okay, all right, okay. Well, we leave that there just in case we get ourselves into any kind of trouble by trying to benchmark that against the League of Ireland. But obviously, when the funding is at risk, as it is, and dwindling, you have to look towards commercial partnerships, because I guess they can't continue to create the content that they have, very high standard of which we've become used to. So what type of commercial partnerships are they looking at, or what's happening there now? Are they doing those type of commercial partnerships to kind of sustain that level of broadcasting?
Yeah, I mean, if you watch what you might think is a BBC drama, or if you watch Doctor Who or something like that, you might think, well, the BBC has made this. And in a lot of cases, they haven't really. They might be the broadcaster who's picked up a bit of the bill, but outside the UK, it might be on Netflix, it might be on Amazon, and really it's a co-production because the BBC can't afford to make these things on its own anymore. The budgets have gone up, the money's gone down. So quite often, Doctor Who is a great case, because really it's been made with Disney now, and episodes are dropping on Disney Plus around the same time that they're available on iPlayer, which is messing up the release schedule in the UK. And it also destroys that collective experience. But the BBC feels that that's about the only way it can really afford to make these shows nowadays. And you've got this eternal tension. is it better for the BBC to let its programming go and find people wherever they are, to circulate on social media, you know, just to provide the raw material as a public good? Or do they want people to be loyal to the BBC brand and then be more willing to pay the license fee? Are you better serving the British public by just getting the information out there, by doing the hard work and letting others take the credit? Or do you want to be something that people really feel an affinity to? And, you know, the challenge with a lot of younger audiences is you talk to people involved in streaming television in particular, and they say people now come home and they turn on the TV and they might have a button on their remote that says Netflix, and they will just press that immediately, that the homepage for television for them is Netflix. And they might check out a couple of other services if they're interested in one thing in particular, or they're searching out a specific program. But the BBC iPlayer is sort of a second-rate thing that they'll check out after Netflix. And that is the challenge. And in RTE, you know, I've been reading some of the stuff in terms of its own streaming services and the problems that it's been having. It's a real challenge to keep up just with the technology that the US companies have. It costs a lot of money to build these platforms, and it'll never quite be as good as a big Silicon Valley company making billions and billions.
Yeah, and that's the reality. I mean, it is no longer the case that the terrestrial channels are the first port of call, and those broadcasters just simply cannot compete with the screening services and the global tech companies. So then we have to look at where is the future for them. But one of the things that BBC has been renowned for, I guess, is its news service globally, and also the impartiality of that. Where does that piece lie when you're having these discussions about, and it was very funny, I was looking at comments from the BBC chair, Samir Shah, who said that radical funding options such as subscriptions or advertising, I wouldn't have thought either of those are radical, but where does that all sit when you're looking at the impartiality of news?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, with RTE carrying adverts and the way that in the UK, if the BBC even took a tiny bit of sponsorship cash on its domestic channels, it would be seen as beyond the pale. Now, look, there are a few options on the table for BBC future funding. And I think that the one that should be looked at the most is in terms of whether there's a levy on something else. Do you put a levy on broadband connections, for instance, mobile phone connections? Is there a way that you can, tax something else to have the same effect and provide a pool for public service money? But all of this just comes down to, you know, how do you maintain something on the scale that the BBC has at the moment? Because the thing you alluded to there in terms of its global reputation, it's often when I talk to people in the US, in American media, that they're like, wow, you guys must be so proud of your BBC. And then I think of all the stories I've written about people in the UK giving it a kicking and go, no, not necessarily quite as you think. So, you know, you talk to someone in Washington, D.C., and they'll clear, you know, anything to get on the BBC. A senior senator will do anything they can to get their BBC hit. They really respect and they like being on it. And, you know, they'll turn to the website and for the same reasons. And if you talk to people in Hollywood or in entertainment industries on the East Coast, they will feel the same. They're like, the quality of writing, the quality of staff in the UK, you know, the lack of commercial pressure in the same way when you're working with the BBC to just make the best possible product. They love it and they find it baffling, the kicking that it gets in the UK sometimes. So I think there's often an interesting thing in terms of the global audience and separately the global reach when it comes to the World Service, which historically was funded by the British Foreign Office as an agent of soft power, really, to broadcast around the world in multiple languages. And then as part of the Conservative government's cuts in the last decade, they said, sorry, BBC, the license fee payer is going to pick that up, which essentially meant £500 million budget cut for the rest of the BBC. All of this just comes down to cut upon cut upon cut at the exact moment that they needed to be investing. So you've, instead of moving money into digital and trying to rethink the BBC, they've just been busy sacking hundreds of people and making small cuts to try and keep the same number of channels on air, and something's going to have to give.
And it's exactly the same type of discussion that we've just had here. And at the end of the day, you know, it's immersed and combined and entangled with politics, and a big political difficult decision at some point has to be made. But, you know, there's never a good time for politicians to make unpopular decisions. Jim, I have to say it's been fascinating talking to you. I'd love to talk to you a lot more about York and League of Ireland and BBC, but I hope you'll come back to us again. For now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Jim Watterson, media commentator. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Well, we're awash with money as the Dáil returns this week. With just 2 weeks to go to the budget, we'll examine how much the government have to spend, and we'll be looking back at some of the promises they made over the summer. Stay tuned. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, it's the money that nobody wanted. Earlier this week, Apple lost its fight against the European Commission's ruling that it underpaid €13 billion in tax that was due to Ireland. It's being viewed as a big win for the European Commission and their efforts to clamp down on sweetheart tax deals. But what does it all mean for the government here, both economically and politically? And as the Dáil returns this week, we're going to look at what's in the coffers to spend and what they've been promising over the summer. So we've a lot to get through, and to do that, with me now are economist Jim Power and Daniel Murray, who's the political editor with the Business Post. Guys, you're both very welcome.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.
Now, Jim, as simply as you can, and this has been going on since 2016, just one simple question. Why did we get this money back this week?
Well, basically, the European Commission, and I guess this week, the European Court of Justice ruled that the tax treatment of that the Irish government gave to Apple some years back qualified as state aid. In other words, Apple got preferential treatment in this country because of the way in which it had its whole structure set up. And so it's simply down to unfair state aid at the end of the day. And the European Court of Justice decided this week, it made the ultimate decision that actually this tax should have been paid to the Irish government. And over the coming months, the 14 billion plus that is now sitting in an escrow account will be transferred over to the Irish government.
Mm. Now, do you think that that ruling, which is effectively saying that it was a state aid, do you think that that affects our reputation and, more importantly, our capacity to get new international inward investment?
Okay, I think, one of the first things that needs to be pointed out is that, number one, we're not sure yet if there will be other countries laying claims to some of this money. You know, could the French, for example, argue that Apple should have paid some tax in France? I'm not sure what the status of that is, but we wait and see. But the point is that the European ruling was based on tax structures that existed here some years ago. I mean, this saga has been running on for 8 years, and some of these tax structures that it would take a total genius to understand had been in place for some time before that. But at the end of the day, over the last 5 years or so, the Irish government has closed all of those loopholes. And we signed up over the last couple of years to the OECD's Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 corporation tax structures. So Ireland has now very much become part, I guess, of the international corporation tax regime. So I think it would be unfair and wrong to attribute what happened some years ago to the current situation in Ireland. But I think it's really important for the Irish government to get the message out there that actually, we have addressed all of these loopholes, which the government never believed was a loophole, obviously, or they wouldn't have appealed it. Mm. But we have closed all of these loopholes, and that we're now, we have a corporate tax structure that's aligned with the rest of the OECD effectively. Will it damage Ireland's ability? First of all, will it damage Ireland's reputation? I don't think it should. Because if you think back to July 2016, when the CSO famously revised GDP growth up to over 26%, and Paul Krugman tweeted leprechaun economics, at that stage, Ireland's international reputation was very definitely at a very low ebb internationally. But a lot of time has passed since then, and I think the reputational damage to Ireland today should be limited. In terms of attracting for future foreign direct investment into the country and maintaining what we have, I don't think this tax ruling will have that much impact, to be honest. But I think what is much more important now is to make sure that the non-tax element of what we're offering foreign direct investment remains as strong as possible. Mm. So I would be arguing that this $14 billion should be used to enhance Ireland's long-term competitiveness. So addressing areas like housing, energy, water, these things which are now so important for multinational companies operating in this country is what we need to address.
Yeah, I suppose that's really why I'm asking that, because there's already a lot of concern in the international investment space about those things like our capacity to deliver energy, utilities and all that. I'm just thinking that is this another sort of hammer blow, and a delicate one if it is, and the government trying to pitch this as a legacy issue. So just good to get your views on that. Daniel, I want to bring you in here to talk about how they might spend this money, because I have no doubt that as the political editor, you're going to spend the next few weeks or months, depending on when the election will be, looking at what different parties plan to do with this money in their manifesto. I would imagine at least one page is going to be dedicated in every political party's manifesto to how they might spend this. Any indications, early indications from the different parties about how they might spend it?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's certainly going to be an election issue. I mean, the first question is about when this money lands, and the indication so far that it takes a couple of months for the money to actually be transferred from the escrow account to revenue and then into the government coffers. So it looks likely the money will be here next year, and the government themselves have already said it won't make any impact on the budgetary parameters of the budget that is to be delivered in a couple of weeks' time. But beyond that, then, yes, it will become an election manifesto issue for different parties. But also we have to remember that we're talking about, yes, 13, 14 billion in additional revenues to the government from this windfall Apple tax judgment. But that's added on top of existing surpluses that were projected in the years ahead, mainly because of massive corporation tax receipts, which, since this case was initially taken, have grown sixfold from about 5 billion to what's expected to be close to 30 billion this year. So next year, there was already projected to be in excess of 8 billion of a surplus in the public finances. So add another 13, 14 billion on top of that, and you're really talking about a crazy amount of money. And exactly how they're going to spend it, there's a number of different options, and there's pros and cons to all of them. They could take the boring route and pay down public debt. We have a public debt at the moment of about 220 billion or about 42,000 per person. That's massive on a per capita basis, and paying that down would be the prudent thing to do, using some of the money to do that. But of course, that wouldn't be very politically savvy, and people might feel like the money is just being taken away from them. Equally, they could go for a big once-off package. We've got very used to these kind of cost-of-living packages. And another one is being devised for Budget 2025 to be paid out within this year. But when you're talking about that level of money, $14 billion on top of the surpluses, you would hardly even be able to come up with enough measures to put the money back into people's pockets on a once-off basis. And anyway, that could result in inflation. I think the more likely scenarios, and this was indicated by the Taoiseach during the week, is for infrastructure. And the reason being that infrastructure is a kind of a once-off or a temporary spend. And of course, this money is a windfall and therefore once-off in nature. So being able to put it into infrastructure over the next couple of years, and possibly a combination of some spending in some other areas and paying down public debt, seem to me to be the most likely way that this money will be spent.
Yeah. Jim, you're an economist and obviously advising a lot of the great and good. If you want to put your prudent fiscal hat on there for a second, I'm just trying to think about who makes the decision about where this gets spent. Does it go back into the pot, as Daniel said there? Do the ESRI, IFAC, Central Bank get involved in advising? What do you think actually will happen? Okay, it's going to be next year when it happens, but do you see it being just a ring-fenced amount of money that's going to, you know, be used as a once-off, as Daniel has said there? And if you were advising government as the chief economist, what would you advise them to do?
Well, as Daniel said, before this money was announced, and before it lands, we were already running a surplus of, we're going to run a surplus of about $8.5 billion this year. And all of the advice the government has been getting from IFAC, the ESRI, the central bank, is that this money should, this surplus should be used very carefully, that if it is spent, it will add inflationary pressures to what it regards, what they regard as an economy growing above potential. So you can be guaranteed that is the advice that those bodies will be given government. Probably pay down debt would be the advice that will probably be coming across most strongly. However, as has been the case with government in recent budgets, these pieces of advice will, of course, be ignored. And at the end of the day, it is the pragmatic political process that will decide how this money is used. And I would totally agree with Daniel's perspective there that investing this money in infrastructure to enhance the long-term growth potential of the economy on a gradual basis, because if you pump that sort of money into infrastructure overnight, you come up against all sorts of capacity and inflationary constraints. But I do think that that should be top of the hierarchy.
And when you say infrastructure, Jim, do you have a particular idea?
I do indeed. Yeah. I mean, I would look at some of the biggest constraints to the future growth and development of the Irish economy as coming from, number one, housing, number two, energy, particularly the development of alternative energy, because the grid here is under massive pressure at the moment. Thirdly, I think the water infrastructure needs massive investment. So, the fourth area, which I think is incredibly important, is investment in education, because at the end of the day, as Ireland's corporation tax advantages are gradually whittled away, which they are, we need to focus on the non-tax elements. And I've mentioned three of those, which I think are really important: housing, energy and water. But the other one is the quality of the labour force we have here.
Yeah, and that's always been context. a huge part of our attraction to investors.
So in that context, in having a properly resourced education system is absolutely essential.
Yeah. Daniel, just to pick up on those three things that Jim mentioned there, at the top of the list for him was housing. I mean, you know, we're heading into a budget and then an election, highly political atmosphere at the moment. It'll be hard for them, won't it, to resist putting a big chunk of that money into housing, because look, that's the biggest problem in the country. That's certainly the biggest problem for all of the parties in Dublin. Do you see that, you know, we might see new kind of, plans come out in advance of the election, a bit like the Sinn Féin one, that they just ring fence this and they say there's going to be more state building on housing?
I do think you'll see those kind of plans, but where you won't see them is in the upcoming budget. The parameters for the budget were set in the summer economic statement. The government has given a commitment that they're not going to change. They may change slightly if the government raises taxes in certain areas, which it'll probably do, but they're not going to use this money within those parameters. So as you say, then it becomes an election issue. And absolutely, I mean, a combination of the projected surpluses in the years ahead and now this additional money, I think all parties will be looking to and have already started to come up with plans for how this money can be spent. Housing and infrastructure absolutely being top of the list there. And, you know, that being not just because of the existing housing crisis that is affecting so many Irish people, but because of the impact that it's having on the competitiveness of the Irish economy and for all of these multinationals and where the money is coming from in the first place. And one of the biggest concerns in the years ahead with regards to foreign direct investment and with regards to these corporate taxes and whether or not they will be windfall in nature or continue into the future is the competitiveness of the Irish economy. And these multinationals are looking at housing deficits, energy deficits, water deficits, transport deficits. And they are the main reasons that a lot of these companies are now beginning to look at other jurisdictions. So it's actually no longer a tax issue and about kind of tax competition, which maybe we could be a bit distracted by the Apple tax ruling this week, like it would have some kind of a direct impact on our competitiveness. But it is a historical issue. And the issues today really are infrastructural. And it's something I know the government are highly aware of. There was a story during the week that Apple had met with the government to raise these infrastructural issues and tell them that there was fierce competition to try and move Apple's headquarters from Ireland to other jurisdictions. And they're basically warning that unless these deficits are addressed, that is something that could happen in the future. And certainly that is the case with other multinationals as well.
I totally agree with you with the point that you made there about tax in the future won't be the big draw to the country that it was before. Not just here, I think worldwide, energy and where you get the energy from and the source of your energy is going to be a big draw, and that stability and supply is going to be a massive issue. So requires a lot of long-term thinking, which you don't often see in the run into an election. But just if I could stick with you for a second, Daniel, on that one, you've been watching all summer as different political parties is not just leaking parts of the budget, flying kites. It's a complete, like, you know, it's a spray of leaks coming out ahead of the budget now. What for you have been the key things that you've seen coming from the different parties to try and kind of, you know, define themselves ahead of budget 2025?
Well, Fine Gael, obviously, as a party in government, since when Harris has taken over, has been trying to distinguish itself on the issue that we were just talking about there, infrastructure. It has really tried to set itself out and has proposed a department of infrastructure, and that doesn't have any particular budgetary requirements in an immediate sense, but it raises a lot of questions about how something like that would work. So that is one way that they are certainly trying to define themselves. Childcare is becoming another big election and budget issue, but mainly an election issue. Fine Gael and the Green Party both moving towards a kind of a fully publicly funded childcare and early years schooling model that would almost be absorbed into the public school system. And that is something I think that could become a big issue moving forward as well. The cost of living has remained a major issue as well. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago that we had the first once-off cost of living package. By my count, I think there's been 4 of these apparently once-off cost of living packages and another one planned for this coming budget. And that's something that initially the soundings during the summer from Michael McGrath, when he had been still in the finance portfolio, was saying, look, we're going to have to start to wind down these temporary and once-off measures and move towards more permanent spending, because we might have been kind of papering over the cracks with a lot of this temporary once-off type of spending. But it appears behind closed doors that that argument has been lost, and cost of living is going to remain a key battleground in this budget and then presumably into the election, especially if the election is soon after the budget, which despite the Taoiseach's protests, a lot of people still think is going to happen within 2024. So those are just some of the issues that you can see emerging as key battlegrounds.
Yeah, for sure. Look, a wise man once told me it's very easy to dole out money, but it's very, very hard to try and stop it. Listen, time is upon us, gents. I'm afraid for now we're going to have to leave that there. But my thanks to Jim Power, the Economist, and Daniel Murray, Policy Editor with the Business Post. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.
This is News Talks Taking Stock. Coming up, the fallout from that US presidential debate. Lauren Feder from the Financial Times is going to be joining me after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnson. Now, would it be one of the moments that ends up defining this year's US presidential election? Well, Tuesday night's debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump could be defined as fractious, as the Vice President looked as she landed a number of punches and obviously dented Trump's most prized asset, his very delicate ego. One person who was looking at it all and, you know, has analysed the relationship between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is the Financial Times US correspondent and Deputy Washington Bureau Chief, Lauren Feder, and she joins me on the line. Lauren, welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I don't think there's any question but that the commentariat and anyone analysing this debate, even Fox News, admitted that Kamala Harris was the big winner of Tuesday night. Would you concur with that assessment?
I absolutely would agree. She started off a bit nervous, a bit wobbly, but very quickly hit her stride and managed to rattle Donald Trump, to say the least, get under his skin a bit and go after him on some of the issues where he is vulnerable with voters.
She certainly did that. And, you know, sometimes it seems like a facile thing to talk about when you're looking at the physical presence or the personal demeanor of someone in this context. But in the run up to this debate, there were questions about her, you know, her stature. Would she, you know, be able to command the presence required for a commander in chief and literally stand up to Donald Trump? But I think she did that quite well. What was your view?
You know, I agree. And I think you are right that on a certain level, you might feel as though it's facile to be considering these things. But equally, the debate was televised, watched by more than 60 million Americans. And television is a visual medium at the end of the day. Kamala Harris is nearly a foot shorter than Donald Trump. This was something that was discussed in advance. Would she look diminutive standing next to him? But I think she commanded the stage physically from the get-go. In fact, it's important to remember here that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, believe it or not, had not met prior to Tuesday. And she strode right across that stage, shook his hand, introduced herself in a slightly bizarre moment, but it seemed to knock him off kilter. And she certainly presented herself as someone who was confident and could command the stage in that moment. And I think that set the tone really for the rest of the evening.
Yeah. And the tactics that she used in engaging with him for me were very interesting. I mean, he did try to goad her into talking about Joe Biden, her relationship with Joe Biden, her role in the administration. But it must have been very difficult to resist the temptation to refute a lot of his claims. But she didn't. She stuck to her own messaging. And do you think that, you know, her prosecutorial, you know, experience stood to her in that?
It must have, right? I mean, she has years and years of experience of standing up in a courtroom and having to think quick on her feet. You know, equally, it's important to kind of concede here that while she, by you know, most measures, won the debate, there were criticisms too. There were some analysts, but also I've spoken to some voters who say, you know, she was on message, but it was at some points she was repeating the talking points, right? Rather than necessarily engaging with the substance of the questioning. I don't think that will necessarily hurt her in the long run, but that is part of that message discipline there, as you could tell when she was reverting back to some of her preparation, perhaps.
Yeah, and in the wake of the debate, one of the polling companies put out some statistics which were very interesting about what people felt they knew about her afterwards. And 48% of the undecided voters who they spoke to said they wanted to know more about Kamala Harris. Maybe here we're seeing evidence that the lack of an 18-month run-up where a presidential candidate might be tested in the normal way is going to hurt her, and that not using the traditional media and that constant FaceTime with the public will actually, she'll run out of time and they won't know enough about her in the end when it comes to voting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could look at that as a glass half full or a glass half empty. There's an opportunity there for her. There aren't many opportunities in American politics, quite frankly, these days when we have such a divided electorate in the U.S. And so many Americans are pretty set in their ways and their views about these two individuals, or certainly about the two parties, about the Republicans and the Democrats. Donald Trump is a known quantity to the American public. He's a known quantity to the world. He's been on the national stage now for at least 8 years as a politician, let alone as a kind of reality TV star before then. And while Kamala Harris has been the vice president, she did run for president once before. There are a lot of undecided voters, and even decided voters, even some Democrats, who say that they'd like to know more about her and what her proposals would be, what she would do in office. That is a great opportunity for a candidate in the year 2024. But as you say, she does not have a lot of time. And in fact, early voting is going to get underway in a matter of days in many states across the U.S. And that means that while we all have our eyes on Election Day in November, the votes are going to start being tallied pretty soon.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that it's so close, really. One of the things before we move on for the debate I wanted to ask you about was Donald Trump's position on foreign policy, really, here. You know, as you said there, we got what we knew we would get from Donald Trump. He hasn't changed. Look, let's face it, he's not going to change. He doesn't need to. He can keep his core vote like that. But every presidential debate is taken at a moment in time. And this moment in time, what they're trying to do is persuade swing voters and undecided voters that they are the candidate who they should move toward. Now, just on the foreign policy element of it for a moment, the two things that kind of struck me were his comments on Ukraine and also how he spoke about Viktor. And that was the only EU leader he actually spoke about. What was your assessment of his foreign policy contribution overall?
Well, you know, I think in foreign policy circles and certainly outside of the US, there were a lot of raised eyebrows, shall we say, when President Trump was asked point blank, you know, do you want Ukraine to win the war? And he wouldn't answer the question. He just said, I want the war to stop. You know, that was seen by a lot of people as a statement that he doesn't want Ukraine to win, or at least a avoidance of the issue. You know, and given his past comments about Russian President Vladimir Putin, that is certainly, I understand, worrying to U.S. allies in Western Europe. You know, he has been pretty consistent in his messaging about the war in Ukraine. He keeps insisting that he would end it on day one. The impression that leaves a lot of people is that he would hand over territory to the Russians. But, you know, he hasn't put a lot of detail on that. So, unfortunately, we'll have to kind of wait and see whether or not he does become president and what he does. You know, when it comes to foreign leaders, I think the Democrats and Kamala Harris in particular are trying to paint Donald Trump as kind of being in the pocket of, or certainly being enamored by dictators and autocrats. And it was notable when the only world leader that President Trump really name-checked was Viktor Orban, saying, you know, he thinks I'm a great guy and he thinks that we need President Trump back. You know, it was interesting to me hearing that line in the debate and also then hearing other people talk about it afterwards. You know, I spend a fair amount of time on the campaign trail with Donald Trump and hear him speak to audiences of all sizes. He mentions Viktor Orban on the stump often, I think a lot more often than people would realize. They have a relationship. Orban was at Mar-a-Lago in Florida earlier this year, and Trump clearly values that. And I think, you know, listeners can draw their own conclusions about what that means.
Just before I leave the Ukraine thing, I mean, do you think that his motivation around those decisions are based on money? I mean, I'm just thinking of the NATO contribution that he made. And, you know, ultimately his claim about that is he forced nations to kind of pay up and made their contributions better as a result of, you know, warning and threatening to walk away from it. Is this motivated by some geopolitical positioning on his behalf, or is it just about the contribution that America makes?
Well, I think there's probably a lot more there than we can get into. But I do think that this issue of NATO contributions, countries making their 2% target, this is something that Donald Trump has talked about for years and years. It's something that he will continue to talk about. But really, at the end of the day, I think it fits into this wider theme for him, and one that does resonate on the campaign trail. You know, it's important to remember that the average American voter probably doesn't know much about what is required of members of the NATO alliance when it comes to their contributions. But they do feel like the U.S. has been engaged in too many foreign entanglements or sent too much money or sent too many troops abroad over the last 25 years. And that's where this all comes back to Donald Trump's kind of America first message. And I think that was what he was trying to convey to voters at home, is that I'll put America first. I'm not going to let anyone tell America what to do. And, you know, we're not the world's policemen anymore. Now, obviously, there are voters who feel differently, but for his base, that is a message that resonates.
And the polls are so close now, Lauren, that it's there or thereabouts. What could or is shifting anything? But perhaps the biggest thing that might change the dial actually didn't happen in the debate at all. It was that intervention of Taylor Swift. How did that go down and how was that viewed?
Big news, right? You know, big news even for the Financial Times. Yeah. Taylor Swift came out and endorsed Kamala Harris. Look, I think we can overstate these things, but she is obviously the biggest pop star in the world at the moment. There was a lot of attention paid to her endorsement. Equally, the Democrats have long enjoyed popularity in Hollywood and among big stars, and it hasn't always gotten them over the line. In this case, though, I think one of the interesting things in Taylor Swift's announcement was her encouragement to younger voters and her fan base to register to vote. Mm-hmm. And it'll be kind of interesting to see over the next couple of days if we do, in fact, see a bump with that demographic. You know, younger voters in the U.S., as in Western Europe and the rest of the world, are less inclined to vote often than their older counterparts. Mm. And so if Taylor Swift is encouraging younger people who tend to skew Democratic to sign up to vote and to be involved in the process, then that very well could make an impact, particularly on the margins when, as you say, this race is just so close that it can be decided by a couple thousand votes here or there.
And, you know, you attended the previous debate with Donald Trump and Joe Biden, which became such a consequential debate. Really, do you think that this debate will ultimately shift the dial for her in her favor? Or do you think that it's one of those debates that, you know, launched her on the stage, she did well, but it's not going to move the needle?
I think it's undeniable that the debate earlier this summer between Joe Biden and Donald Trump changed the course of American history. It ultimately set in motion a series of events that resulted in President Biden stepping aside and handing the torch to Kamala Harris. It's hard to imagine that this week's debate would have such massive consequences. Mm. But, you know, it certainly had tens of millions, more than 60 million, almost 70 million Americans tuning in on Tuesday night. I can't emphasize enough how big of an audience that is and just how much of an opportunity it was for both Harris and Trump. Now, given Harris did so well, we'll have to see whether or not there's a meaningful change and shift in the polls here. You know, I would caution, however, that there have been many examples in recent history of candidates who have been widely seen to have, quote unquote, won the debate and not gone on to win the election. Hillary Clinton was very strong in her early debates against Donald Trump. Mitt Romney was widely seen as winning his first debate against Barack Obama back in 2012. Hillary Clinton, Mitt Romney, these individuals never became president of the United States. So it's important to remember that we should take these debates with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. And we look forward to seeing what Donald Trump's ultimate reaction to all of this will be, because no doubt with an ego as bruised as his is now, there'll undoubtedly be some consequence. But for now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Lauren Fedor, US political correspondent and deputy Washington bureau chief at financialtimes.com. Lauren, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. While we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first every Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks as always to all of this week's guests and to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments about any of today's items, do email us on takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.